Chema. So before we enter into the Gita, today is a special day, 20th November, and I've been asked to say a few words. First of all, I have read several accounts which people speak about with reference to 17th November and the things thereafter. But the big problem is that we try to understand a moment based on what happened during the last few hours or few days or few months. But actually, if you really go deep into ourselves, then nothing can be really understood unless we fulfill these two conditions. We have to take into account the far back trail, which goes actually beyond lives, which means the divine will which is operating in creation. On a humorous note, somebody was asking me about history. I said, one thing, you can start from where it all began. The event in 1640 AD took place when it started. Started way back when creation began, because that's how one can understand that what is the original divine impulsion and then the distortions of human consciousness. These are the only two things which is what Gita speaks about ultimately. The second is when we go deep behind these surface appearances, because appearances are always deceptive. So, and third important thing is to keep aside all biases, which includes rational biases. So very often people believe that they are being impartial, even impersonal, very big word, if they are not bringing into considerations emotions, passions, etc. And they are being very impersonal, very impartial when they are using reason. In the lower nature, it may be okay. But reason has its own inbuilt biases. To the reason, senses, what they are reporting is the truth. To start with, this is how the premise operates. That's how we have so many questions about death, what happens after death, let alone the mother's great departure. They are using these words. But the reason cannot tell us even what is beyond any death, because that's its limitation. It depends on the data of the senses. So it can never be truly impersonal or an instrument of truth or anything like that. So when we shed all these things, then we have to just take into consideration data which other than reason is revealed to us. And I have a very simple question which I ask, because when I came here, people used to say, when mother was there, when mother was there, or when mother was here. This used to happen, that used to happen. And someone very closely connected, I won't take the name. So I ended up saying, please don't say that. So obviously she was a bit, what do you mean we shouldn't say that? I said, because we have never felt that she has never been there. She's always there. No, you don't know how she used to look after. I said, exactly the same feeling today, that she's there. So, your experience is of a physical form, and through that, whatever you connected, our experience, and many of us, it's not mine, countless people now that I meet all over the world, I go, she is here. She is here, there, everywhere. And she has her own ways of working, of gifts of grace which people receive, they understand. So if this is true, which is the fact of inner experience of people, then this second part, which also unfortunately came out through some very great sadhaks, without a doubt, that the work is postponed or work has been left. How can it be so? The third thing, which mother herself gives a clue, that it's not a question of this body, that body, all bodies are one body. She continues to work. So, from the practical point of view, it makes no difference. In certain ways, it has become easier to connect to the mother and Sri Aurobindo. As the mother said that, you know, when Sri Aurobindo, after the Again, I'm using words, we'll talk about it a little. Mahasamadhi days, he said. Earlier, people used to say that it doesn't respond to the letters. It is not true. Now, it is so easy that we can go to the samadhi, we can pray, and there is the response. So, it is equally true now that you pray to the mother, you go to the samadhi, or you just go inside and there is a response. So, this is one part of it, that nothing changes. Actually, practically nothing changes, and many ways it has become so much easier. This one part of it. Second, if we look at the physical body, people expected that suddenly, partly based on a misunderstanding, I would say, of her, some of her statement, that she, people thought that one day suddenly, you know, a current will flow through and the whole body will look luminous. Now, this is, if you ask me, very childish way of understanding. This is not how, that kind of abrupt miracle, Mother and Shubhendu would not do that. It's a process. So, once we understand it's a process, then we have to see this process went on over years and very far. Very far. So, how far did it go? Mother speaks about that. She says she has formed the new body. She says that, you know, she is wondering to switch into the new body or not. When to switch on. Whether it will have a compact density or not. All this she mentions, that bones are the last resisting part. If you look at the mother's body, which unfortunately people keep on flashing, last darshan, which I am sure the mother would not have liked it. This is my feeling. So, you see, it is so short. It is as if compressed. As if there was so much which was already transformed and that last bit was left behind. And she says that she is trying to, she at one point says that, shall I just leave this part and go ahead? Then she says, no, I have worked so much on these cells. They have been very nice. I can't just, you know, leave them aside. She had that compassion. So she worked upon every bit of cell which could be deprogrammed, integrated with the new creation. Then at some point of time, there are cells which absolutely refused or for whatever reason, and that was left behind. That's how that old body and the new body has emerged. There are several experiences of people, which includes Lalita, which includes that Hablik lady, Mrs. Sharma, almost immediately, within some time, Nolnida, Champaklalji, that they are in their now new body. We don't see them, that's our limitation. We don't even see the inner divine, forget about, you know, the new body. But the reason is that because our eyes are not tuned to this new body, much this easy to understand. Would an ant recognize an elephant? It doesn't recognize. It doesn't have that format or capacity. And the difference is almost like that. So, slowly human consciousness will get more and more tuned to the new body, the new creation, including the eyes. Eyes are very interesting organs. But that's a different story. So the eyes have to be at some point tuned. And that's the process going on, whatever time it takes. And we'll be tuned. And that's the time of the rapid transformation between the human and by the contact of the full divinity. That's how I look at it in a very simple and straight way. And as I said, based on all the data. There's so many more things which I've spoken of in a whole talk on 17th November and 5th December. So these words, Mahasamadhi, I am not fond of it. This is my personal view. Mahasamadhi implies that when a yogi is living, he goes into states of trance where he withdraws from the outer world. Mahasamadhi is when he completely withdraws. That's what Mahasamadhi means, of the great saints. So where has she withdrawn? You can't use that word. So what is the word people ask? So I'd mentioned that great leap. Great leap, the great transmutation. From 62 she is saying, I am no more living on this side, I am living on the other side, which she meant about the domain of the dead. I am no more in the body. At one point she says, earlier I used to say I am no more in the body because I was never in the body. Now I say the body is outside me. That means she is now fully identified, integrated with the new body. And that which we called as a body is outside her. There is a difference between the two. I am no more in the body means this is still my body, but my consciousness is outside. Yogis can experience that. But the body is outside me is a different experience. This experience comes only after people die. Because then it's like the body is there, you are identified with, fully with that. They know. But she has to keep that link, so she says that link is through pain. That is the reason why she had all those pains she was undergoing to, every time she would have a brush with the body as it is, it would pain. Because the body is not used to this tremendous flow of consciousness, this power. It would grate, it would resist, it would react. And the only reaction we know when something so vast, stupendous, unknown invades the body is panic or pain. She was fearless and she is free of all that. So, but the pain is there, physical pain. So that's the mystery of the pain. Rest of it is going to unfold with time. Many things are going to change. All the scaffoldings that she had built are going to be dismantled. Only few things will remain which are necessary. I am talking right now of the ashram context. I don't know about Auroville, is a different story altogether. But many of the scaffoldings which are necessary to build the new creation, they have served their purpose. Nalinda also spoke about it. It's a very interesting talk on the brink. So many things are going to be dismantled. Just core things will always remain. And that's the core we have to connect to. So with that we can enter into essays on the Gita. We are on chapter 24, which is a summary of all the first six chapters. And this is where Sri Aurobindo says the gist of Karma Yoga. So ordinarily we will see that many places people who speak about, there are many Neo-Gita books available in the market. Gita in the workplace, Gita in this and that. And basically if you go through them, in trying to oversimplify the Gita, they actually remove its main core. For example, supposing somebody asks that, you know, when I act, should I focus on the results or not? Obviously, if you focus too much on result, your action will be hampered. This is logic, common sense. But this is not the Gita, Nishkam Karma. Because obviously, if you are too much, this is a counseling I have given to some Indian cricketers who played. I said, see, you are all the time thinking of performance, so your work performance is actually getting affected. Free your mind from that. Enjoy the game. So this may sound like very much like Gita, Nishkam Karma, but this is not Nishkam Karma. Kama is there behind. Only you have learned that, well, if I keep the results out, I'll do well. Second thing is, this problem of Arjuna could be resolved in a very simple way. Shri Krishna almost hints at that in second chapter. He says, look here, your problem is whether I should fight or not. And yes, killing is a gory crime. But, you know, you are ethically bound to, as a Kshatriya, to fight whoever is standing against justice and righteousness. So you have to fight. Problem is solved. After that, there is no need of... Probably if Yudhishthir was there, that's all was necessary. So first six chapters, Sri Krishna gives the foundation of the yoga. Then what is the need of the next 12 chapters? So there are few things. Primary practices have been told. Desireless action, Nishkam Karma, equality. All this have been told to Arjun. These are the mainstay of the practice of the Gita. But Arjun may ask that you have reconciled work and knowledge, but you have only hinted about love. Toward the end, sixth chapter he comes. hints about love. Me, he says, me. Mat para, you concentrate on me. So suddenly there is that element of bhakti. You have not told, what is bhakti? I don't understand. Arjun may well ask. Then, Arjun may well ask, all this you are saying, you know, he has hinted that there is beyond the mutable and the immutable a third status. He has hinted that in the first six chapters. He said, but what is that? What is that Paramatma or Purushottama? I don't understand. Whom should I really offer? Whom should I worship? Who is this being? He has clarified that if you talk only about mutable and immutable, you cannot solve the problem of action. And this is something which I keep talking to all the Vedantists to go and give lecture. Your Mahashunya is very nice, but it's completely unrelatable to the world experience. And if it's completely unrelatable to the world experience, at least personally, I have no interest in it. For the simple reason that, well, that means this is a facade, this is all a grand illusion in which we are living. Then there are very uncomfortable questions, how this came into being and why it came into being. But yet, it is, Gita also says that from the mutable, you have to enter into the immutable Brahman. So how does Sri Krishna resolve it? And he takes it to the third status, which is the Purushottama. So yesterday also I was having a discussion that, you know, basically how you have to look at it is that there is this divine being and all that we are seeing here is something of him which is either distorted, deflected, diminished reality. Then it makes sense that if my love is a diminution of divine love, a distortion of divine love, then I can upgrade it. Then transformation makes sense. Or even if you take that classical Vaishnava form that there is the perfection, you go there. But then it leaves this, that this diminished form was only to catapult me into that. But if this is a diminution of that reality, then it can be transformed. If it is a disfiguration of that reality, it can be reconfigured. If this is a distortion of that reality, the distortion can be set right and we can become true image of the divine. So this is the logic of the Gita by bringing in the third status. So now Arjun is asked not just to do Nishkam Karma, but to connect with that. So what is Gita actually saying? It is not simply saying Nishkam Karma. They are all methods. It is saying you have to rise to the higher status than the limited human nature. If we don't bring this, then all the teaching of Gita has no meaning. That's the whole... I may practice Nishkam Karma, but I may do it that well. It's a very good strategy. And it may help me. But that's not the Gita is. Gita is a Yoga Shastra. And it not only Yoga Shastra. Sri Krishna is referred to as Yoga Yogeshwara Krishna, where all the questions of human existence have been answered. So the core of the Gita is shift your center of consciousness from the human to the divine. First important thing. Otherwise, all else is only words. How to do it? Now it gives that image of the, there is the senses. All the time we are engaged with the world through the senses. Knock, knock. Yes, who is there? That's how senses are responding. Every scene, every sight, they are responding. So you have to withdraw from that kind of habitual reaction. So where do the consciousness go? Into the mind. Now you have stopped the senses, but mind is enjoying. That's why he talks about nigraha. Force suppression. Sannyasai doesn't help because your mind can continue to enjoy. All of us know it's so difficult. Mind has tasted objects. And if you try to make it dry completely, there are some paths which are like that. Then yes, you can eventually, if you dry it completely, that's a long process. Then still the ego will be there. So mind has dried completely, there are no objects. But that little I is still there. So that's one path people take. But Sri Krishna is not showing that path. He says, do an inner renunciation. So what do I do with the mind? It will play with the object. Then he says, this mind needs an object. Asta buddhi is something still higher. To turn the mental activities, which includes cognition, thinking, reason, emotions, will towards that higher truth, the divine. That's how the mind will become quiet. Because if you just don't give, people often say that, I try to make my mind blank or silent, it doesn't, it won't. It's a monkey, it will make you sleep, that's all. So give it an object, and that object is the divine. When you give that object, that itself is a difficult process. But at least there is an object to start with. Then as the center is lifted up into the divine, then the question is, how do I act? Because desire has gone, which was the basis of my action. Then Shri Krishna reveals that there is a divine will operating in this creation. He gives his own example. Why do I work? There is a higher divine will which works in the creation for Lok Sangrahart, for carrying the march of humanity forward. Now you have to align with that will and act. What that will is, your mind cannot surmise, it cannot put it into format. That divine, I will do whatever the divine will ask me to do, except raise a sword, because he will never ask me to do it. That's how somebody told the mother. And mother asked him, how do you know that? So all mental conceptions, all systems, philosophical trappings, ethical ideas, opinions, viewpoint, they become a bar. They are strongholds of the ego, where we find very difficult to chase them away. We can quieten the vital, but the mind holds on to these very... That's why people can't understand God's play. When something in their idea, when the event is contradicts something which we unconsciously hold in our mind. Oh, I have turned to mother, everything will be fine. And we have our own idea of fine, everything good. And good is whatever pleases my ego. Now see, unconsciously it is there. Something happens. It hits us. So what does the mind do? It doesn't surrender and wants to know God's will. It says, you know what? There is no God. Or he is cruel. Or sophisticated way of justifying it, the karma. Poor God must be amused, laughing. That give me a chance to tell you what it is. So there is a divine will which operates, which looks beyond the present life, looks beyond the form. It has the map of all lives in front of it. And the action that we are going to do has already been fulfilled at some level. And Arjun has to act today for that great. Anyways, it will be fulfilled. But he has a choice to become Nimitta Matra. That action can be delayed, but never eventually failed. That's how the mother at one place write, the spiritual destiny always stands. It may be delayed, but it can never be stifled. So this is the essence, that look, there is a higher divine will operating. All these exercises to tune to that and act according to that. Of course, this is very tricky at times, because I may say I am going by the flow, and I may say divine will is acting. Now that is between the person and the divine. That's all I can say. I have seen people act according to preferences, according to rules, ideas. But using the term that in my silence I act according to divine will, fair enough. Divine has his own way of revealing that this is not how I operate. Because all divine action, even the destruction, is always accompanied by a deep compassion, inner peace. There is no turbulence. That's what Arjuna revealed. How does one who is established in the divine, how does he act? And Shri Krishna says, always inner peace and inner felicity will be his state. He will never be free of, I mean, he'll... It doesn't mean liberation means I am liberated from the inner peace. Always. Because there is a touch of the divine. Even when there is a destruction, there is love in that destruction. That's how the Divine Mother also says, and Shivinda says. If he... people say that God made hell for punishing. I think much better of my beloved. Even if God made hell, it would be made out of love. Always love will be there. And that's why even in the worst of tragedy, if we just come in contact within with the divine, we feel that divine love supporting us. So this is the gist. And now we can quickly read some passages. The gist of the Karma Yoga, chapter 24, page 247. And initially, after describing a few things, I'll come to page 249. And he says, what is the solution of the Gita to the dilemma of Arjuna? Action. Should I or should I not? Gita is saying, first you should decide, who is this? Who is asking? If I have to put in pure Vedantic terms. If it's Arjuna who is asking, this little fellow, then it's a different story. But Arjuna must first discover who Arjuna is. Then the next question comes. So he says, the Gita's solution is to rise above our natural being and normal mind, above our intellectual and ethical perplexities, into another consciousness with another law of being, and therefore another standpoint for our actions. So this is the important shift, where personal desire and personal emotion no longer govern it, where the dualities fall away. So for example, one is no more acting with even this idea that it has to succeed. Do it your best, give your best, because it's a worship of the divine. But people draw conclusions, if an action doesn't succeed, mother's will was not there. All these mental cobwebs have to be washed away completely. Then the divine will manifest. Shubhendra at one place says that somebody asked, can God fail? He says, why not? The world has advanced with about half a dozen revolutions, and almost all of them were failures in their own time. A classic example is French Revolution. It failed outwardly. Napoleon was exiled, people were guillotined. Today, Indian constitution starts with this. Freedom, equality, fraternity. I mean, I felt so joyous. People don't know. They start with the preamble. That's preamble. But these are the three things enshrined as the core values of the constitution. But of course, this freedom is not, I'll do whatever I feel like. That's the devil quoting the scripture. Freedom, equality, communist equality, all are flat. That's not equality. And of course, unity is not that let's have a party together and do what we feel like. So that's a different thing. That's a different story altogether. Only when we rise to the divine consciousness can we understand why, how all these deep terms will carry a meaning. So that's the first step. Dualities fall away. The sign will be dualities fall away. If I am troubled by failure, success, all this equality is the sign that one has really touched something true and genuine. Where the action is no longer our own, and where therefore the sense of personal virtue and personal sin is exceeded, which includes personal virtue, mother's instrument. What? She can pick up a blade of grass and make it her instrument. Mother's big instrument, that even worse. It's a big ditch opening by your side. The whole world is her instrument. Yesterday we were having somebody ask, when we pray to the mother, does she act through her vibhuti? It doesn't matter. She will act through anything. A roadside man, suddenly if you have prayed, and he may become her instrument to do what has to be done. So this idea, even the egoism of the instrument, all these things, the dualities fall away. Personal virtue, because personal virtue goes away, personal sin is gone. So all want to cut the knot of karma, don't say I am a good guy, no more a bad guy. You are still in bondage. I am not, that's the solution. So good and bad both fall away. Where the universal, the impersonal, the divine spirit works out through us its purpose in the world. There is nothing like personal mission. Where we are ourselves by a new and divine birth changed into being of that being, consciousness of that consciousness, power of that power, bliss of that bliss, and living no longer in our lower nature, have no works to do of our own. Gita has used a very beautiful word for it. Sarva sankalpa sannyasi. But works arise in you. The will arises and you act according to that. No personal aim to pursue of our own. But if we do works at all, and that is the one real problem and difficulty left, do only the divine works. Those of which our outward nature is only a passive instrument and no longer the cause. So this is the relation between nature and soul. In classical traditional Vedantic yoga, nature is chalana, maya, call it whatever, and you are trapped in it. Soul has to be freed from it. Then nature is no use. With its past momentum, it will act. That's how many yogis continue to be. But they say, it's nature, not me. So, this is one way. This philosophy has been very detrimental to India, this particular thing. It's all nature. So you can make it dirty, make it whatever, it doesn't matter. It has gone deep into the bones. So the Gita is so important because it takes you beyond. Nature is an instrument of the divine. You can't discard it, that this nature. Very interesting story in one of these Shivpuran, where, in this Shivpuran, where one of the rishis is very surprised after many years of tapasya, he comes and says, now Shiva is sitting with a woman, Parvati Mata. He says, I left a sannyasi, where is he? Now I am seeing a grahasth, he has lost his way, all these things. He is holding a doubt. On top of it, Shiva arranges a meeting where all the rishis come and he comes with Mata Parvati and she sits by his side. He says, this is blasphemy. He is caught in the snare of a woman. How can it be? So then after the akhyan, the lecture, they have to all do parikrama. So this Sringi Rishi, he says, I won't do. I'll do only your parikrama. I recognize you. You are poon. You don't need another to be poon. Shiva just smiles. He says, anyways, do the parikrama. Now he can't take parikrama like be in between. No? He becomes a little fly. Goes around Shiva. Comes out. I have done my bit. Then Mother Parvati says, I see that you detest nature. Okay, I'll take myself completely away from you. He collapses. All sadhana, all yoga is through nature. Thought is nature. Feeling is nature. Will is nature. Effort is nature. Can we ever discard it? And then, after one has realized the divine nature is the instrument for a divine action, instead of nature being the instrument of the ego, it becomes an instrument of the divine. That's how the Gita resolves this dilemma. Again, next passage, page 250. This upward transference of our center of being and the consequent transformation of our whole existence and consciousness, with the resultant change in the whole spirit and motive of our action. Motive must change. That is the sign that it has been transferred. And the method Sri Krishna gives is not a mechanical one that keep concentrating above the head. No. He says keep referring everything to the Supreme. He will take hold of you and pull your consciousness where it has to be pulled. That is the method it gives. The action often remaining precisely the same in all its outward appearances makes the gist of the Gita's Karma Yoga. It's not about changing outer action. You may continue to shoot arrows. Fine. But change the motive. It's no more your battle. It's no more the battle for your brothers. No more even the battle for righteousness. It's a battle because such is the divine will. End of the story. Act under that. But first you must shift. So motive has to change and the consciousness shift. And now very powerful. Change your being. Be reborn into the spirit and by that new birth, proceed with the action to which the spirit within has appointed you. May be said to be the heart of its message. Whatever the spirit appoints. It may tell you to fight the war, tell you to withdraw. Some people get so attached to chair, for example. And they just keep justifying it. Mother has appointed. Once I had a discussion. Mother has appointed. I said, did she say termlessly, eternally? Of course, a thing may be valid at one point of time in temporal existence, it may be invalid after even 1 year. How do you know? So this idea that sticking on, holding on, you have to see for the divine work what is best. But there are people who continue. They can't see that it is attachment to the chair. But that's how life is. So he says that it has to be what the divine wants to do. It may be the same work, it may be completely different work, it may be just go to another field, absolutely fine. It should not be that no, I did so much work there and see how people are mistreating me, even throwing me out. God is giving you respite. So many different ways, you know. You are always in joy. You are never troubled when all this happens. Or again, put otherwise, with a deeper and more spiritual import. Make the work you have to do here your means of inner spiritual rebirth, the divine birth. And having become divine, do still divine works as an instrument of the divine for the leading of the peoples. What is the purpose? For the march, leading the march of mankind. Awakening, people should, you know, more and more be aligned to the divine will. Therefore, there are here two things which have to be clearly laid down and clearly grasped. The way to the change, to this upward transference, this new divine birth, and the nature of the work, or rather the spirit in which it has to be done. Since the outward form of it need not at all change. So transfer it up, and then what work will be, it will depend on the will of the spirit. So, then, page 253. Very beautifully, Sri Aurobindo in a very simple way describes that there are two lives we lead. We have, no? Interestingly, on the hand, we have a main lifeline and we have an inner lifeline. I often use this example. So there is the outer lifeline. So actually in astrology they say that even if your outer lifeline is weak, if your inner lifeline is strong, it will help you go through. So there is the ordinary life lived on the surface, and there is a deeper soul life which we are hardly aware of. So these are the two lives which are going on simultaneously in everybody. Ordinarily, we are living in the ordinary life, moment to moment, ordinary motives, ordinary ways, ordinary desires, ego and all the rest, at highest reason, but all part of the ordinary life. So from there it should shift to the deeper life. This is what the Gita is asking us, first thing. So page 251, this two lives, he says, from the psychological point of view, 253. We may say that there are two lives we can lead. The life of the soul engrossed in the workings of its active nature, which is what is called as bondage. Bondage to ignorance, it doesn't mean that it is like somebody's tied. It means you are so engrossed, it cannot realize its true nature. Now, of course, there is a reason why the soul gets engrossed at a stage of evolution. All that is a different drama altogether. But the fact is, when it doesn't know itself, bondage is like when you put somebody in prison, after some time, he responds only to the number, not only to his name, not even to his name, because there is a photograph clicked with a certain number. Kaidi number 91. Okay. Respond. Like in Air Force. Oh, Air Force is not. It's a lovely organization. Each one of us had a number. And that number has got so imprinted. All other numbers you may forget. That's your number through which everything else operates. Of course you have a name also. But as a prisoner, complete imprisonment, you may completely lose your identity, because now everywhere you are recognized as cell number and your prison number. So the soul is your shirt number. So all the, you know, that's how soul is bond, becomes a bond slave of nature. Now, why it becomes bond slave, all that is a different story altogether, which is comes later on. Limited by them, bound by its personality, subject to nature, and the life of the spirit, superior to these things. So the second life is life of the spirit, superior to these things, large, impersonal, universal, free, unlimited, transcendent, supporting with an infinite equality its natural being and action, but exceeding them by its freedom and infinity. So one is where the prince is in the, as a slave, life of Moses, many such stories are like that. And the other is that he is actually, his real identity is that he is a prince or a king. But there he has to forget it. And because he is forgotten it, he is limited even in his action. We may live in what is now our natural being, or we may live in a greater than spiritual being. This is the first great distinction on which the Karma Yoga of the Gita is founded. This is what we miss in most of these typical neo-spiritual accounts of the Gita. Gita for practical life. Because the moment you bring in higher, deeper, greater, spirit, God, then the book won't sell. So that's how you see this missing. Many books you'll see. Gita for everyday life. And pick up like, you know, do nishkam karma. But there is something much deeper. That's a process for something else. The whole question and the whole method lie then in the liberation of the soul from the limitations of our present natural being. In our natural life, the first dominating fact is our subjection to the forms of material nature, the outward touches of things. So what are these outward touches? These present themselves to a life through the senses, and the life through the senses immediately returns upon these objects to seize upon them and deal with them, desires, attaches itself, seeks for results. The mind in all its inner sensations, reactions, emotions, habitual ways of perceiving, thinking and feeling obeys this action of the senses. The reason too, carried away by the mind, gives itself up to this life of the senses. This life in which the inner being is subject to the externality of things and cannot for a moment really get above it or outside the circle of its action upon us and its psychological results and reactions within us. This is a classic example. I'm having a cough. Huh? So naturally people. Now, everybody's attention is on the cough. No, the attention should be on what is coming through. I'm not bothered about the cough, but then, you know, emotions get attached. Oh, look, having cough. Then reason gets attached. Why don't you get it checked? Have you taken this medicine? This could be this problem, that problem. See, all this paraphernalia. So at some point I have to say, please ignore it. In fact, ignore me. Because the more you give attention, the more this fellow will become worse. I don't care. I mean, it's like, it's irrelevant if you ask me. It has no place, no importance. Because its importance is only with regard to the, as an instrument of manifesting the divine. Yes, voice is important in that sense. So you take a little hot water and she takes care of it. And if it goes to a point, you can take medicine. But to think about it, to react. Senses are all the time reacting. With everything they are reacting. They are seeing and reacting. But this is what the mother, even for 20, see, people were seeing her. And what were they saying? Oh, this old lady. She says that. They're having these suggestions of death around. And she says that, I can see clearer, I can hear better. But they think I am unable to hear. Why? Because the senses were reacting. And they're a very funny instance. And of course, a funny with a touch of irony in it. Very a sad way of, you know, a sad humor, if I may use the word. That one day she is saying, you know what? I heard that she knows that a ship is there, and she receives that voice, and ship is tooting, and she hears it as Om. She says, it's so beautiful, you know, the senses when they begin to change. She says, but she mentioned it to somebody and he says, no, no, mother, actually this is a ship. Of course she knows it's a ship. You see how the mind immediately. And that's how till date people doubt. Will it be? Will it not be? Because senses. They keep asking. Sometimes they ask, where is the first supramental specimen? I said, you know, actually it is you. You don't know. Today also somebody, Superman is a very, very, very far away. I said, for you, yes, it must be your truth. But need not be everybody's truth. It's your truth. You can stay with your truth. Nobody to convince, need to convince. You're already convinced that Superman is very far away. So for you, it is far away. As simple as that. See, we don't see there are so many mental cul-de-sac, blind alleys in which our mental consciousness is jammed and stuck. And based on that, we start drawing our own conclusions. So, this is the first thing, the senses getting past all this. So, page 255. A mastery of the senses. So he says nature acts through tamas, rajas, sattva, but that we'll have a detailed chapter on that. So we'll not talk about it now. A mastery of the sense and inability to do without all that they hanker after is the first condition of the true soul life. Recently, very recently, a date was suggested for some program somewhere. I won't mention the place because somebody who listens may understand. So, that's a place where the relics have been installed on a particular day. So, I said, okay, we can keep it that time because they want to hold a big program. She says, yes, that's a good idea. Then they discussed. They said, no, everybody is saying it's very hot. I said, what program are we doing? We are not meeting and to sit in air-conditioned offices and discuss about supramental life when we are not even a mentalized creature. So this is how life of the senses. And this is the first necessity to come out of that. It's the natural state of humanity, not about one person or another person. But why do we get seized by the senses, few lines below. But this cannot be done so long as we are subject to desire. So we must get rid of desire. Senses, why do we? Because we desire the objects of the senses. Ah, this is very nice. This car, if I have this model. I had this fellow who came for consultation, cardiologist. He said, Doc, I have a big problem. I said, what, you're yourself a doctor? He said, no. When I drive the car, I see a car in front of me and I want to overtake it. I said, fine, overtake it. He said, no, then there is another car in front of me. So then there is a third car in front of him. So see, when you desire an object, then you are subject to the senses because these objects are presented to us by the senses. And then the whole drama starts. That's a different story altogether. So, desire we have to get rid. We must get rid then of desire. And that propensity of a natural being destroyed, the passions which are its emotional results will fall into quietude. For the joy and grief of possession and of loss, success and failure, pleasant and unpleasant touches which entertain them will pass out of our souls. A calm equality will then be gained. So this is the sign actually of surrender. If somebody has surrendered, there will be peace and joy always. This is the sign that you have surrendered. If you are troubled, that means we are in the process of surrendering. But surrender means by its nature. So he says that when this, because they excite the passion. Oh, this is the object. Oh, this is what I want. So passions come in, then emotional excitement comes in. So people say, how to make it quiet? This is the path he is showing us, how to make it quiet. Value the soul life and value it to that extent that it's for us a do or die thing. Then slowly, you know, because if you don't value it, if it's as the mother says, 5 minutes I'll sit or half an hour meditate. So it doesn't work like that. So a calm equality will then begin. And since we have still to live and act in the world and our nature in works is to seek for the fruit of our works, we must change that nature and do works without attachment to their fruit. See, that's the logic. Logic flows from above downwards. So we have to get rid of the fruits. Otherwise, desire and all its results retain. But how can we change this nature of the doer of works in us? So one is that, okay, I have renounced the fruits. Still I am the doer. I am doing with a nishkam bhav, but I am the doer. I am a sadhak. I am doing sadhana. I have renounced everything and come to ashram. Then you have not renounced. You are holding on to what you have renounced. So you are holding on to this. So that's how it works. So how can we do that? Nature of the doer. By dissociating works from ego and personality. My work. I will do it my way. My work is ego. My way is personality. So by dissociating, then how will we act? By seeing through the reason that all this is only the play of the gunas of nature, and by dissociating our soul from the play, by making it first of all the observer of the workings of nature and leaving those works to the power that is really behind them. So that is the witness state where you practice it till it becomes deep enough. Few lines below. Then we must learn to still the mind. After the senses, the vital has been quietened, the ego self, then the mind. The mind is continuing to play. Then we must learn to still the mind. We must attain that absolute peace and stillness in which we become aware of the calm, motionless, blissful self within us, which is eternally untroubled and unaffected by the touches of things, is sufficient to itself and finds there alone its eternal satisfaction. If one begins to feel that without the divine one is nothing, that is the state one has to reach. Only with that contact, that's what one wants. Mother has used the word aspiration for the divine. So, this is the program for quietening all these and for the true soul life to emerge. But now comes this question that, okay, senses have become quiet and vital has become quiet, the mind is becoming quiet. Page 256. But here there are two difficulties. You know, Sri Aurobindo is taking us by the finger and we may say, now what is the difficulty? No, there are two difficulties. What is the difficulty? First, there seems to be an antinomy between this tranquil and immutable self and the action of nature. This we have already talked about in the previous chapters. Wherein that is the will of works which would make the action of our nature possible. See, basically we have become free even from the sense of being the doer. Still, action is there. What should be the basis of choice? How would I choose my action? I am not the doer. Does it mean that anybody gives me anything and I say, okay, this is mother's work, and starts running from pillar to post? What is the will in me? That is coming at the end. My mind is quiet now and ego is hopefully gone, and then there is only peace and bliss of the divine. But then, that peace and bliss, can I do indifferently whatever I want to do? Or whatever is coming in front of me? No. That's not what the Gita. So it takes to the next level. So that's where the understanding of the Supreme comes in. That he is not just this blissful, tranquil self, but the Purushottama. That we have already touched upon. So I'll go to page 257. Because this is what Arjun asks, if you have already arrived at state of blissful self, then why then this insistence on the most violent and disastrous form of action? This chariot, this battle, this warrior, this divine chariot here. You have discovered through this whole process the blissful silent self. So just live in it, sail in it, take joy in it. Why would you engage into this kind of action? That's the last problem. The Gita answers by presenting the Supreme as something greater even than the immutable self. More comprehensive. One who is at once this self and the master of works in nature. But he directs the works of nature with the eternal calm, the equality, the superiority to works and personality which belong to the immutable. So he is peace and bliss, but he is also power and knowledge. So he acts, but he acts with that state of inner peace and joy. But he acts not purposelessly, not like, okay, I'll do whatever I feel like doing. He acts with a certain purpose in mind, which have been hinted about the Lok Sangrahartha. Gita doesn't use the word manifestation, but we can use the word, it's progressively manifesting himself. This, we may say, is the poise of being from which he directs works, and by growing into this, we are growing into his being and into the poise of divine works. From this, he goes forth as the will with a capital W and power with a capital B, P of his being in nature, manifests himself in all existences, is born as man in the world, is there in the heart of all men, reveals himself as the avatar, the divine birth in man. And as man grows into his being, it is into that divine birth that he grows. That means one is in that state of immutable, tranquil self, full of joy, peace. Now action will flow through such an individual according to the divine will, and you cannot put it in any format. With this person, I'll be like this. With that person, I'll be like this. Or I'll be like this with everybody. I'll be good to everybody. Even the most noble conceptions, you don't know how she will direct, at what point. You may be, that's why plasticity and consciousness Shubindu insisted so much upon. Because without plasticity, we cannot engage in this kind of action. Any rigid idea, any limited mental, that's why the mother and Shubindu brought up the ashram in total freedom. This was the meaning of freedom. So that the divine will deal with each one according to the divine vision. Freedom never meant do whatever you feel like. Yes, you can do whatever you feel like, but then the divine will deal according to its deeper vision. You can't set a standard format except what is understood, like you're living in a collectivity. Obviously, you can't put loud music in the name of God. That's understood. That's common sense. That's basically, you know, civic sense. But the reason is this, that divine will acts in freedom and with infinite plasticity. You can't put it in a fixed format. So if we have to grow into his being and act according to his will, we also have to arrive at that wideness and plasticity. Works must be done as a sacrifice to this Lord of our works, and we must by growing into the self, realize our oneness with him in our being and see our personality as a partial manifestation of him in nature. So we are portions of him, must be even as him in all our actions. That's what the mother told Dilip Kumar Roy when he was worried, mother may send me away, 51. Because I have doubted her all the time. So mother once calls him and tells him, you know, we are here only to please Sri Aurobindo, the Lord. We are not here to please ourselves. We are not here to please others. Look at the completeness. We are not here to please ourselves. We are not here to please others. So many people take it as an excuse. Oh, I can be harsh. No, this is not what is meant. Third one completes this. Many people say, oh, I am not here to please you, so I can be any cold-blooded, hard-hitting. That's not like people interpret straightforwardness and frankness that way. No, the third sentence, third part. We are here to please only the divine. Is this how he wants me to act, speak? Well, so the last passage. This is the essential thing to be done. And once this is done, the difficulties which present themselves to Arjun will disappear. So first six chapters have given all this hint. The problem is no longer one of our personal action. For that which makes a personality becomes a thing temporal and subordinate. The personality becomes only a instrument. The question is then only one of the workings of the divine will through us in the universe. To understand that, we must know what this supreme being is to himself and in nature, what the workings of nature are and what they lead to, and the intimate relation between the soul in nature and this supreme soul, of which bhakti with knowledge is the foundation. Bhakti is the crown. The elucidation of these questions is the subject of the rest of the Gita. This is where first series closes. Then you will see actually from chapter 7, it's more about what bhakti is, what this supreme being is, how does he deal with the world, what is nature, what are the different modes of nature, different kinds. So it's the relation between the supreme and the soul. That's what is vibhuti, what is the divine will on Kurukshetra. That's how it reveals itself. But the foundations are laid in the first six chapters. That's why Shubhito has elaborated first six chapters over 24 chapters. Okay. Chema.